Ancora? Ma dove me li metto che non c'ho nemmeno il posto?
Uso a obbedir tacendo.
Ma state scherzando?
A quale biscotto si riferisce mia sorella? Non è ferro?
Nemmeno io.
Una serata dedicata al grande maestro del cinema, capace di far ridere con amarezza e riflettere con ironia.
Che fate tutti qui?
Mario Monicelli. Mercoledì alle 21:15 sulla 7.
You're listening to Because You Watched with Charlie and Francesco. I'm Charlie.
And I'm Francesco.
This is a podcast where we take a film that enjoyed significant mainstream success and use them as a starting point to discuss lesser-known films that we think deserve greater attention. But this is not one of those episodes. Instead, what is it, Francesco?
Well, what day is today, Charlie?
Well, why, it's Christmas Eve, sir.
Oh, so it's a Christmas special.
I suppose it is.
Oh, how
well,
nice.
Since it's a holiday special, I think we need to bring on our recurring holiday guest, Mr. Peter McNamara.
Hello, I am the festive Peter McNamara.
We're not doing alliteration.
We're not doing that this time around. Okay.
Oh, the festive Francesco.
Yeah. Hey! Yeah.
The partying Peter and the
Christmas-y
Christmas
Charlie.
Yeah.
That sounds like Christmas turkey. we all tucked into a nice Christmas Charlie.
Like Leap Day Charlie or Leap Day.
Leap Day William.
Leap Day William.
Like our Halloween episode where Peter decided on a film, we are going to talk about one film in particular, and it was Francesco's choice this time. Why don't you tell us a bit about it, Francesco?
Well, the film I chose today is Parenti Serpenti, a 1992 film by director Mario Monicelli, also known with the English title Dearest Relatives, Poisonous Relations, which we all agree is a rubbish translation, isn't it?
Way more words.
It's way more words, and it doesn't rhyme. Snake relatives. So the synopsis reads, like every year, everyone is going back to the ancestral family's home for Christmas holidays. But this time, the old folks have a surprise, a good surprise for them. They have decided to go living with one of their children and make him or her inherit the family house. So, this film wasn't my first choice. I was gonna go with 1983 Vacanze di Natale, Christmas Holidays, which is the most famous Italian Christmas comedy ever made, but there are no existing English subtitles of that, not even on DVD. So I chose this film because I hadn't seen it before, but I was very familiar with the director, Monicelli, who is one of the most famous Italian directors at the national level, and even internationally, his films were nominated for several different Oscars. He got like 4 nominations for Best Foreign Language Films. And this film, Parenti Serpenti, Snake Relatives, is a late film by his. It's interesting because it's a comedy of stereotype. It's a comedy set around the Italian Christmas table. But it's also weirdly cynical. It's got an interesting tone. And I'm just wondering what you guys thought of it.
Well, we're going to get into the dark and interesting tone once we hit the spoiler mark. But for the first part, I really enjoyed it. I thought there was a lot to like in it. I found it genuinely funny and, yes, in a dark way, but quite charming. The family dynamic, yes, it was the 90s and, yes, it's in Italy. But I found it very relatable. Mm-hmm. Genuinely, I really enjoyed this film. What do you think, Peter?
Yeah. As a sort of, when it starts out as a family comedy, it's never cheap for minute-for-minute laughs. It's, you never sort of feel put out of it by there being too much of an attempt to make it constantly funny. It's just a good family comedy by way of really good characters. Yeah, it's you know, as you say, we'll get onto the later, the darker, more cynical tone of it. But for that whole first half where it's more of a family film, the title betrays that something's coming, so you always know that there's this other element that's on its way. So for those reasons and more that we'll discuss, I thought it's a really good film. Yeah,
this film is more part of the tradition of commedia all'italiana, Italian comedy, which Monicelli was one of, if not the biggest example of. And it does have a lot of things common to Italian comedies, like social commentary on the North-South relations, and a lot of stuff that's more typical of Monicelli himself, in that it's very melancholy. It's rarely, as you said, Peter, it's rarely a straight-up, like, laugh-out-loud comedy. Even at the beginning, it's very observational, almost, and it's very episodic. But I don't know how much of this is emblematic of Italian Christmas comedies as a whole, or just Monicelli himself?
Okay, because when you said I'm interested in doing an Italian Christmas comedy, and then obviously you didn't choose this first, I assumed they were part of the same tradition.
Well, they're both Italian Christmas comedies, but this is not part of that series of horrible comedies, which are called Cine Panettoni.
Okay, so it's specifically a franchise of films rather than a genre that goes wider.
Yeah, yeah, franchise, like same directors, same actors, etc.
I also really like that the humour comes from like the little micro interactions and even microaggressions that happen, and that really sets the stage for the larger conflicts that rear their head later, but they're planted so early on for comedy and then they emerge as tragedy.
Yeah, and Peter, you said earlier that like the title kind of spoils the fact that everything goes sour, but I feel like that's present from the beginning because this family is introduced as being incredibly gossipy and incredibly judgmental, but in a very passive-aggressive way. And the whole film is told from the voiceover point of view of the youngest child in the family, who is, he's giving a school presentation about his Christmas holiday.
Well,
and
we find that out right at the end, don't we?
Yeah, but like I was suspecting that the way he talks, the way it's like he's reading an essay that he wrote. So there's this voiceover by the youngest kid in the family narrating the whole film, and it starts off with him just talking gossip about the people in his town, like people who aren't even related to the main family at all. Just gives us this list of characters,
and never appear later in the film,
but it gives you a perspective of how his family just talks shit all the time.
It's always, as mum says, we were introduced to what's the woman who's implied to be sort of the town's prostitute's name, and he says he's informed that that's where men go for something, and even
it's good
it's
good for the military.
It's good where the military men go for a morale boost, and even though the kid has no idea what this means, his parents still feel compulsion to tell him.
Yeah, and then once the actual family relations start, so this on Christmas Eve, they go to... It's a complicated family situation. The matriarch and the older parents...
The mum's parents.
Yeah, so the child who's narrating, his grandparents and his parents' parents are hosting Christmas dinner and Christmas Eve dinner and Christmas lunch. So they all go there, and once you get into the inter-family dynamics, there's clearly already a lot of tension there, because this is a town in Abruzzo, which is roughly center-south Italy. It's very rural, but like a lot of the children have gone off to the north, to Milan, and married off to people from the north, so they live, you know, more posh or modern lifestyles, and there's just a lot of bickering. The scene where they give each other gifts, where like the posh woman is like, oh, I give you a fancy bottle opener or a corkscrew.
It's a very refined object for classy people.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a corkscrew with a dolphin on top of it. It looks awful.
I
solid chrome.
I like that. I like that corkscrew. Yeah. I'm sorry.
But yeah, so yeah, they're bitchy and bickery from the beginning. That was my point.
But also they're bitchy about each other, but also to each other, which is also a lot of... That's half the fun as well, in that the sister-in-law from the north is just horrible to her daughter.
Yeah.
Yes.
Who wants to be a dancer and is constantly reminded that she's eating calories.
Well, that's Gina. And then immediately after we see the three women together for the first time, a voiceover says, and then mum and auntie Melina go to talk about Aunt Gina behind her back in the kitchen. And so immediately after the first family scene, we get to the first gossip scene.
But what's fun is that it's presented from the outset. If you take away the narration as like quite a wholesome, all the family in one place, and yet it's funny, and yet they snipe at each other, but it feels very traditional, and then the voiceover adds this sort of disconnect, and then the more you see of them, the more dysfunctional they all appear, and I think that's a lot of fun as well. It's also kind of strikes me when I see it in real life as well, just how quickly they divide into the men in one room and the women in the other room, specifically the kitchen.
Yeah.
And, you know, that happens in my own family. That's not a specific thing to this film, but it's... Do you ever feel like you're very used to something, but then you see it in a film, and even though it represents your own life, you still find it very striking?
Yeah, not only the men in one room, the women in the other room. Women in the kitchen often doing work, like washing dishes, while men are watching TV and playing cards during Christmas dinner. And a lot of the women in this film, one woman in particular, her frustration is really about having to do household labor while her husband is completely incompetent.
That's the narrator's mum.
Yeah, Lena, yeah.
There's also, we should talk a bit about the grandparents.
Oh yeah, of course.
who are, I think, really well played in this. But you have the grandmother who's very beleaguered and very busy and...
You're very put upon.
Absolutely. And the grandfather who seems to be suffering from some form of dementia.
We're just told that his memory is going right at the start.
And he seems to be quite delusional about a few things. So he used to be a carabiniere, like a gendarme or a policeman. And he seems to still think that he's going to be called back into duty. A day later, he shows up on Christmas morning wearing his full uniform, which is clearly from like 50 years before.
Feather plumed bicorn hat, ready to go to midnight mass. Yeah.
Oh God.
But is that a thing as well? I mean, I don't know if this is me viewing it from a Western or British perspective, but carabinieri I associate a lot with, you know, obviously they precede fascism.
Yeah.
But in the same way that when we talked about Stolen Kisses, there is a sort of legacy of collaboration that is just sort of underspoken and played for laughs just because it's so normal because of the intervening decades. Did you read, as an Italian person, do you read this sort of obsession with the carabinieri as being a sort of link to that period of Italian history, or is it just the ridiculousness of his delusion?
I was wondering about that, and especially like in which period of history was he a carabinieri, because if you work in law enforcement under a fascist regime, chances are you're going to be working for the fascist regime. But I can't quite place that, because like whenever you read about Italian history or watch movies about fascism, you don't really see police or carabinieri. You see the fascist troops, like the fascist police, the black uniforms, the black shirts. So I don't know what the role of carabinieri was during that time, like if they were even doing anything at the time.
I think literally just based on a couple of American books I've read, their main job was actually fighting the mafia.
Okay.
In southern Italy specifically. Mm. But literally that's just based on The Sicilian by Mario Puzo.
Well, yeah, no, because I've read a couple books like from the 50s and 60s, so right after the war,
episode. Yeah. Not everything has to be relevant.
Yeah. Yeah. No, in our Godfather 2 episode, the film that I talked about, We Still Kill the Old Way, I've read a book by the same author, which is set in Sicily in the 1960s, and the protagonist is a carabinieri who's like, is a former partisan resistance fighter, and is very adamant in fighting against the mafia. But most of the other carabinieri around him are former fascist troops. So, like, there is clearly a link, but like, the implication there is that they used to be like black shirts, and then they became carabinieri after the war. Not that they were carabinieri during the war.
it's like in Clockwork Orange that the droogs become policemen.
Yeah, exactly.
But also, like, probably the more relevant thing, because this was, what was this,
92, because it's right after the Berlin War.
It was made in 91, but released in 92, so yeah.
So one of the men in the family, which one is it who's sort of the young boy's father occasionally derides as a communist, and there's
The young boy's father is a Christian Democrat.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the mother's brother is a communist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But has got his job through his brother-in-law's Christian Democrat connections.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, and the father says he's Christian Democrat, but swears he never voted for them.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
But
he seems to be the sort of man that just likes to complain.
Well, you know, Christian Democrats are... You know.
Are they like the Christian Democrats in Germany?
So I'm not familiar with the German version.
Like,
I know they,
centre, but centre-right.
Exactly. So they were the centrist party. They were, like, allegedly the glue between socialism and fascism. In practice, they were working with the church and all the conservative institutions, so they were, in fact, conservatives.
Honestly, there's so many, specifically because it's an Italian comedy, there are a lot of things which are extremely specific to the setting.
Yeah.
And as much as I talk about it being relatable, there's a few things that I don't immediately pick up on. So one of them being the carabinieri thing, that I'm not sure if it is a reference to fascism and the ridiculousness of someone who is associated with that period being so delusional. Likewise, if someone makes a joke about the Christian Democrats, I don't understand it on the same level as if someone had made a joke about the Liberal Democrats in this country.
Yeah, but I don't think you need to be Italian to understand this film.
No, I don't think you do at all, but I think you do to understand like the little references and have that culture. Yeah. We talk a lot about cultural shorthand on this podcast.
Yeah, well, also, I think, you know, as the first half of that comedy goes, you know, it can be enough to know that one of them is a reluctant member of a mainstream political party, one of them is kind of the communist of the family, and the dad used to be a serviceman in a certain time period of Europe. Europe. So yeah, you don't, all of those things work for a sort of chaotic family comedy scenes, even if you don't know specifically what they are.
You kind of have a grasp of the spectrum.
Yeah.
I think now would be a good point to add a spoiler marking,
yeah,
because we're going to start talking about stuff which isn't covered by the synopsis and takes place after.
So what is covered by the synopsis is that the two older parents want to leave their house and go live with one of their children to take care of them. What isn't covered is what happens after that, and this actually happens like over an hour into the film, like over like two-thirds of the way into the film.
So if you can watch the film, watch it and then come back to this episode, or if you think this movie's 30 years old and it's impossible to watch anywhere, and I'm just going to keep listening and hear what these idiots have to say, then by all means keep listening. But just so you know, you've been warned.
So the parents want one of the children to take care of them. How does the family react? And specifically, there's that line where they say they want one of us to take care of them instead of hiring help because they love us.
Well, yeah, I think it's really important to have the moment before they ask that included, because the grandma goes to the table and she says, you know, us living here alone, it can't go on. We'd like to get out and spend more time with our children. And all of the children are clamoring. They go, oh, of course, mother, we'd love to have you.
Mama!
And she said, oh, you know, because I went and I visited a home because I thought that none of you would want me. And of course, they all think that she means just for a visit. And so they're telling her, of course we want you, we promise we want you over, we want you to spend so much time over. And then she says, okay, well, you know, in spring we'll move in, and by then please let us know which house we're moving to. And the whole family falls completely silent.
But there's also, you know, they also had the incentive that they will get half of their pension to whoever they're living with, and they will also leave them the house.
The house in which the film takes place, the
which is more of a flat.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's a very, very small town with a small house. But it's also, they say it's not much, but I think, so what happens here is that now all the passive aggressiveness of the first half turns into active aggressiveness. Mm-hmm. And you see them at the same time finding excuses not to take the parents in, some of which are absolutely hilarious, and finding excuses to take their parents' stuff, like the stuff that's in the house.
Yes.
But not the parents.
But not the parents, yeah. So.
Oh, there's that wonderful bit where she's like, Grandma left me that dresser when she was dying, said I could have it. And he's like, you were one at the time when Grandma died.
Oh, it's my first memory.
It's such a good
fact,
bit.
If you asked me what my first memory was, I would have said that, of course.
It's really funny. But also the disconnect between, like you said, all this sort of clamoring of, oh, we'd love you to spend more time with us, and even, you know, you can move it. And then as soon as they're separated and they go to a cafe, it's the complete opposite, and it's just the speed of that.
Well, also, I mean, you know, you say about how quickly they move on to divvying up the contents of the house. That the cut from the dinner where they hear that their parents want to move in, they're all sat in a cafe except for Alfredo, who is the only single member of the family. And all of the children there, not the children, the grandchildren,
the weird adult children.
Yeah, yeah. all of the grandparents' children say, well, it has to be Alfredo. They nominate the one member of the family who's not there, and then immediately move on to deciding who gets which of the valuable contents of the house.
Yeah.
Without checking on Alfredo. And then there's that marvellous jump cut where, before they finish the line, just wait to see Alfredo's face when he sees this, and they're still saying that line as we see Alfredo's face, and he's appalled.
And yeah, the reason why they nominated Alfredo is that, oh, he's single, he's got a whole house to himself, he doesn't need the extra money like we do because he doesn't have any children. But then turns out that he hasn't been single for a decade. It's just that the person he's with, that his parents wouldn't approve of, because it's a guy. So, yeah. Ooh.
Have attitudes among, if not grandparents' generation, but parents' generation in Italy changed much since this film?
I mean, like, they changed everywhere. Obviously, like, there's more acceptance nowadays, but it's by no means perfect. The environment of this film is interesting because, like, we have rural, small town folks. At the same time, some of the spouses are in conservative politics or are industrials. So it is an interesting...
Or materialists.
Or materialists, exactly. But you don't get the sense that any of the siblings or sibling-in-laws are outwardly homophobic towards him. They're obviously like quite ignorant about it. Like they're asking, oh, when did you turn this way? What made you go gay? They're not kicking him out of the house or anything.
Well, even Alfredo's quite backwards about it. He says...
He refers to himself as half-woman, doesn't he?
Well, he says, what did you expect with a submissive father?
Yeah. Which is like, I think that's, you know, internal. I don't know if that's what the filmmakers or the scriptwriters think happened, or if that's just his own internalized homophobia speaking.
It certainly feels true to that character and the dynamics of that particular family. Mm. It is quite believable that in that family, if you view it as, I've been cursed with being attracted to men, that they would then blame it on the parent.
No, it's symptomatic of the times, right?
Well, I was going to say, if you compare to the British and American comedies that we grew up watching, and probably the things that were said about, you know, what made characters gay in them back then.
But, funny story, in my first choice, Christmas Holidays, which I will find subtitles for next year, something similar happens where, like, this son of two, like, very conservative upper-class parents turns out to be bisexual, which was actually, like, bisexuals existed in 1983, wow.
But I thought they were invented in the 90s.
Yeah, but he was sent off to study in New York, in America, and he came back gay. So that's kind of like the joke there.
Well, ain't that how it goes?
Yeah. So, but there's also the moment where you find out about every other character, right? So there's the one who's married to that very snobbish woman who is kind of treated... I think they literally called him a cackled at one point. Like in the first half of the film.
They certainly imply that she's getting her nice coat from somewhere.
Yeah.
Yes. And we do also see our narrator's father during the dinner scene when he's tucking into his eel, he starts rubbing his knee on her behind.
Yeah. It's a move. Seen it happen.
Well, but I think how casual she is about it, you know then that...
Something's going on.
He's not making his first move at the dinner table with his knee over a plate of eel. This is... There's something already happening there.
Or if nothing has already happened, she clearly has no problem with it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, but then when you find out that something has happened, you find out in the most bizarre way possible, which... should we spoil it or should we leave it for...
I think you should spoil it because I think it'll be fun to see Francesco explain it.
So, yeah. Okay, so...
And how it happens.
Yeah. So during the whole, like, bickering session, someone lets it slip out that Michele, the guy, is cheating on his wife.
The father of the protagonist.
Yeah, and he asks, how did you find out? Did you have me followed? So they walk out of the room, some time elapses... They bring back a pornographic magazine that shows a poorly disguised him having adult relations with...
His sister-in-law.
And despite the fact that they have the least convincing... Like, they're not even masks. They're like
it's
censorship.
Tape.
Yeah, basically black tape over their
tape.
Eyes. Yeah, like, they recognize them because they're still wearing their distinctive, like, jewelry and watches. And they have, like, birthmarks as well. So, yeah, they got discovered because they took lewd photos and
sent them to a magazine,
I think, is the implication.
It's an odd film.
And then does the magazine then get handed to the two children waiting outside?
It gets thrown out of the room in anger and the two children are there and they pick it up.
Which I think is a nice opportunity to address the children, because I think...
Won't somebody think of the children?
Won't somebody think of the children? I was thinking when you were saying about these, you know, this... stuff that's quite normal about these sort of Christmas traditions and, you know, sort of the men and the women splitting up. I was thinking one thing here that certainly felt quite normal, but I really noticed was that absolutely none of this weekend was for the children. Mm-hmm. And this sort of half an hour with the bickering really, really shows this off, because every time they start arguing, the children get sent out and they have to sit quietly in another room or in a corridor and do nothing while all this bickering is going on. They're so sort of non-existent for the parents that they happily throw down a porn magazine.
Yeah, and yet we hear everything narrated by the kids' perspective, which I think is so interesting.
Well, I think sometimes it adds a little air of innocence. Like I said, when he's using these euphemisms for a prostitute, and he doesn't know, but we do, but he's also telling us. Mm-hmm. When the parents have a snowball fight, that's sort of quite a joyful moment in the film, but when he does it, he gets immediately told off, and you think, yeah, he sort of tries to be a child at one moment in the film, and Monica tries to be a child every now and again and eat chocolate, and every time they're chastised for various reasons.
I think the snowball fight is particularly evident to that, because it's a time where the parents... I mean, yes, the parents are acting like children throughout the whole film, but that is such an explicitly childlike activity.
Well, they do it after remembering that they used to do it as children.
But they won't let their own children do it, and I just think that's such a fascinating moment of, if we're going to be stuck in childhood, we can't allow ourselves to be parents in that moment, because that'll spoil the fun.
Yeah. Do you have more to add, or should we move to the ending?
Yes, let's move to the weird-ass ending.
So, the very conclusion of the film and the conflict, I'll leave this one to someone else to detail.
Well, so, for the whole film, there has been clearly all of the parents, none of them live as modestly as their grandparents, and they're constantly in the first half of the film appalled by, I mean, what is it they called it, a brazier that their grandma carries around?
I misread it as brazier, and I just thought she was leaving a brazier around.
No, a brazier, yeah.
A brazier, yeah. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, well, a little fire pit essentially, yeah. that she's carrying from room to room, and they're constantly trying to persuade the grandparents to buy a proper stove or a heater for the house. And then after all of this sort of half an hour, 40 minutes of bickering and nastiness and revelations, suddenly all of the parents seem very peaceful and cooperative, and they...
Well, they're in a cafe which is playing the news on the TV.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And there's a news segment that talks about how common gas fugues have been and how dangerous they are, so just always check your gas stove. Jump cut to them gifting a gas stove to their parents.
To use instead
of the brazier, and explaining why, you know, etc.
And they're suddenly all happy and cooperative. They're not arguing anymore. They've pitched in. They've all paid equally for this stove, so it's from all of them.
They all go to a party.
And there's a long sequence of them dancing and having a good time for New Year's Eve. And then fireworks start going off, as they do on New Year's Eve. And then you get the final scene where you find out that the voiceover was the kid reading out.
Don't you see the explosion during the fireworks?
I don't think you do. You see it at the very, very end.
I think you see it both times.
I think
you're pausing this.
We're going to check.
So, is there anything you want to say?
Yeah.
That I was right?
as it strikes midnight on New Year's Eve, there are, as there always are, fireworks.
Yeah.
And during these fireworks, we see fireworks being launched off windows and balconies around the town, and then we're cut to the grandparents' balcony, where so much of the film took place, and the whole apartment explodes.
Yeah. And then we cut to the final scene, which is the kid who was narrating the film. We find out that the voiceover narration was him reading an essay about his holidays in front of his class. And he ends the essay with, "It was a good Christmas, too bad my grandparents died." And the Twitcher teacher asks, "Well, how did they die?" "Oh yeah, like their gas stove exploded," or something like that. And this right after, he also included in the essay how nice his parents were to buy the gas stove for them. So I think it's implied that he inadvertently rats everyone out.
What do you think happens after the film?
I don't know. Honestly, I'm happy with the open ending.
I wondered, because that explosion looked large enough, I wonder if the nice family downstairs who caught the eel...
Oh, God, yeah.
...went away
certainly
as well.
Casual.
Little Cesare.
Also, someone walking by, just brick falling over their face. Like, that was a bit...
It was a very irresponsible way to murder your parents,
yeah,
is what you're saying.
Two old people, you don't have to just explore that entire block of buildings.
Can I just have it on record that you both misremembered that scene, and I was right and you guys were wrong?
No, because the shot of the explosion is repeated at the very, very end, and I thought that was the only time we saw
yes,
it.
Yes, and I remembered it correctly. Yeah. So you have to eat humble pie.
I like Christmas pie. It's Christmas. We should be nice to each other.
So I just wanted to get that on the podcast that I was right about an Italian movie and Francesco was wrong. I feel very vindicated right now.
So that's the film. Any final thoughts?
I think it's fun. I think it's really funny and really dark and really fucked up. Something that I didn't struggle with, but something I was thinking about throughout, is the extent to which this is a 90s movie. Mm-hmm. Because there's something about a Christmas movie, and there's something about family movies that are sort of inherently timeless. There are TV scenes, and the cousin is listening to a Walkman.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of things that mark it as a 90s film, but so maybe it's a cultural thing, but I did find something very timeless.
There is something about the dynamics, the family dynamics, that is very universal, but also the fact that because the film is set in such a small town, it feels very out of time. It's like an old couple's house in a very small rural town. It doesn't really have a time and place.
I mean, a lot of it did remind me of Amarcord.
Yeah, for sure.
There's something very seeing this sort of fucked up world through a child's eyes. And yes, it's a very different sort of fucked up world. It's much more relatable and domestic rather than political and terrifying. But the framing of that in a very specific Italian town from the point of view of an innocent, there was something that really Fellini-esque, if not specifically Amarcord.
Yeah, and well, Mario Maricelli has been in the game for ages. His first film was in the 30s, and then all of his most famous films were mostly in the 50s, I would say, but then all the way through the 70s. So
what was his last film?
His very last film was in 2006, The Roses of the Desert.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, he died in like his 90s and he was active throughout most of his life. Fun fact, I met him in person. I was having dinner at a restaurant in Rome. He was known for frequenting. I think my dad took me there with the hopes of running into him because my dad's a big fan. We did run into him. We went up to him and said hi. My dad paid his, you know, compliments and tributes, and he was very pleasant. And then, yeah, he died a couple years after that, I think.
You're telling us that you were responsible is what you're doing just now. You've killed this man.
Well, no, because...
You gave him that gas stove.
Yeah, so that's a joke I was about to make. Why did I run into him? We gifted him a gas stove, and yeah.
So, if that's everything, we're making very good time, and this will be a very easy episode to edit.
Yeah, and, well, this film is not really available to stream. It's on YouTube without any subtitles. I'm sure there's a DVD of it floating around, but I don't know if that has subtitles either. So, if this discussion tantalized you to watch more of this, what I would recommend is that you seek out the work of Mario Monicelli. His most famous films are Big Deal on Madonna Street, My Friends is really good. He's made so many films that are more available than this one in the English language, so I urge you to seek those out.
Okay, since I usually close up, would you mind doing the honors as a Christmas present?
Well, thank you, as usual, to our esteemed producer, Jay. Let me do that again. Thank you, as usual, to our esteemed producer, Jade. Thank you to Molecule for our wonderful artwork. Thank you, Peter, for being a great guest.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Charlie.
You're doing it wrong!
And Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and Happy New Year to all our listeners.